Hello and welcome to The Week at Work. I'm your host this week, David Gibney, and I'm joined by a special guest, Owen Fox. Owen is a Mandate Trade Union member and a member of their National Executive, as well as the President of the Galway Council of Trade Unions. Welcome to the show, Owen.
Thanks, Dave. You're unofficial Western correspondent.
Great to have you. Listen, you're also heavily involved in the Palestinian protests that have been going on as well. So we'll go straight to that before we discuss anything else. Because obviously the breaking news this morning or today is the ICJ case against Israel on genocide. And we now have what amounts to a ruling that it's potential or it's possible or it's probable that genocide is taking place. And the court has called on Israel to refrain from its actions. But the controversy, I suppose, is that they didn't call for an outright ceasefire, which I think a lot of people, I know South Africa itself called for, one of the people presenting the South African case called for the ICJ to come out with a call for a ceasefire, but they didn't go as far. Well, that's how it's being portrayed, that they didn't go as far as that. So what's your take on the developments today?
Yeah, well, I was listening to some of the South Africans today speaking about it, and they said the recommendations of the ICJ court that did come out this morning, it's impossible to implement them without a ceasefire. Yes. So I'm not as despondent as some people are when they didn't call for a ceasefire themselves in the ICJ, but for the interim measures that they have put in place, they are literally impossible to implement without a ceasefire. So I think it puts a lot of pressure on our government, it puts a lot of pressure on the EU, it even puts a lot of pressure on the states to implement something that would put pressure on Israel to stop the slaughter.
Yeah. I mean, that's literally what it's being reported in Al Jazeera right now. I'm looking at it here and saying ICJ ruling can be seen as an, quote, indirect order for a ceasefire. That was my initial reaction to it when I was watching the ruling coming out online there earlier on. But then it was, you know, other people coming out and saying that, no, they could have called. But no, they probably could have. But, you know, it is, as you say, impossible if you were to synopsize it. They're saying it's probable that genocide is currently happening.
Yeah.
And separately saying it needs to stop. It doesn't stop without a ceasefire. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So now we all know Israel themselves are holding firm and saying that they're not going to do anything on it. Like, so they're, that's where international pressure comes to bear. And I see the Irish government are looking for an urgent or immediate legal advice on this, which is incredible that they're only asking for it now.
It is quite incredible. But from reading the statement from the Irish government today on the rulings in the ICJ, or on the interim report for the ICJ, they are feeling the pressure, the Irish government, definitely. And I think a lot of that is to do with the pressure that the Irish people have been putting on the government, from the mass protests that we've seen in Dublin, from different sectors, including the healthcare workers on yesterday outside of Dáil, presenting a petition with 1,000 signatures of healthcare workers, including doctors, nurses, physiotherapists, to the government. And they're definitely feeling the pressure. You can see it in their words and in their statements. They've gone from pretty much at the start dismissing the South African case to now looking for legal advice on whether they can join the case or not. And I think if we keep the pressure up, there's a very good chance that the Irish government will join this case.
Yeah, part of me is frustrated and annoyed about that, because the horse is bolted. Like, they didn't need the ICJ to come out with this to sort of know that that's the right steps that they should take. But like, 100%. Now what that ICJ case has done, I suppose, is put an obligation on all countries, because anyone who subscribes to the Genocide Convention is supposed to take actions to prevent the genocide. That doesn't mean that it takes place the second after the ICJ makes that type of a ruling. That should have been the case initially anyway. So, you know, people, the only organized group or, you know, or anywhere in the world that has done something substantial to stop this genocide is actually the Houthis. They haven't killed anybody.
Yeah.
they did it by trying to block ships, but yet they're the ones being bombed. So it's...
Yeah, and I mean, the US and the UK bombing Yemen as a result of this proves that they care more about international shipping and the security of international shipping than they do the 25,000 people and more that are dead in Gaza. It's astounding.
It's an extremely obvious racism that's attached to this. Because like it's worse than racism, really, because a ship with products on it that's available to sell is more important than a human being. Particularly 12,000 children have been killed, but not a peep. You know, the furthest they would go with 12,000 children being killed is to, you know, ask Israel nicely to be careful. Just be careful with your 2,000-pound bomb that you're dropping indiscriminately on hospitals. Just be careful with that. Like,
And of
but yeah, you
course,
mentioned.
most of these weapons aren't manufactured in Israel. Most of these weapons are sold and given to Israel by powerful countries in the world. So, I mean, that says to me that sanctions, actual economic sanctions on Israel, are the only way to make them stop, because they are not going to stop.
Will we see it?
I mean, I don't think I would be involved as heavily as I am in the solidarity stuff if I didn't have hope. You know, and it's important to keep that hope alive, because I mean, you're looking at it every day, and we have to do something about it. So if it's likely, I don't know, but I'm still hopeful that we can do something, and I'm still hopeful that those sanctions will be put in place and stop this from happening.
Well, I mean, those 2,000-pound bombs, just to get back to what you said there, like they're manufactured in America. I heard that on a podcast the other day. So an immediate action that should be taken internationally is that obviously America needs to stop that. But I suppose the focus is really on Israel on this, but there should be just as much focus, literally just as much focus on the United States of America and how this impacts on them, because they are the great facilitators of this.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And we'll be celebrating them on Paddy's Day. And we have a whole wave of Irish politicians going over to press the flesh and present shamrocks and all other nonsensical things in the face of a genocide. It's hard to wrap your head around it, but
It
especially
really
now,
is
I mean,
a
I'm going to call them out, especially Sinn Féin, because expect more from them as allies. But I'm just quite disgusted with their decision to go.
Yeah, a lot of people are. And I spoke to somebody from Sinn Féin about this, asking what was the point in making that announcement, but also why go? Like, surely I would have thought the smart thing to do here would have been to wait to see what the ICJ decision was, because we knew it was coming out today, and then use that as an informed to make an informed decision about this. Because now you're going to visit a genocide enabling administration over in the United States. It's no longer just visiting Biden, who's given tacit support it to you know, a war. It's now he's giving support to a genocidal regime like Netanyahu has officially through the international courts are saying this. So I just think it was a bit wild to be making the statement that they were going at when they did, or maybe that's the purpose of it, get it out beforehand so that they're not questioned about going to visit a
Questionable.
genocidal regime.
I
Never
mean,
thought about that one.
in the statement they put out, I thought it was interesting that the last line of the statement was, this is to fulfill a promise to the Palestinian ambassador and the Palestinian Authority. And I just I don't know, there's a cynical part of me that thinks that's a bit, it's not great. It's not great. They shouldn't be going, I don't think.
Well, we saw 100,000 people on the streets of Dublin a couple of weeks ago saying, you know, when Bernadette Magaliski made her speech and said it in her speech that we shouldn't give one vote to a single politician that has their arse on a seat in Washington on the 17th of March. Like, there was a massive cheer. It was probably the biggest cheer of the day. So, I mean, it was a decision that might cost them, especially in the year of the local elections, never mind the European
I'm
elections.
sure included in that cheer were many ordinary members of Sinn Féin themselves who've been on the street. Like, so, I was very disappointed by that decision. All right, but, we'll see. They could, as you said, they could certainly regret it with the local European elections coming up.
And listen, tell us a little bit about that protest the other day, because the one outside the Dáil and healthcare workers, I saw, I think you mentioned it was Dr. Phil with a sign held up, healthcare workers are not a target, 60 physios RIP, like, and clear their target. We know they're targeted in hospitals and all, but just tell us a little bit about that protest.
So the healthcare workers, a number of like very concerned healthcare workers, started gathering their colleagues together to try and force their professional bodies and their unions to take a stand on what's happening. And in fairness, the forces showed up there yesterday in force. Fair play to them. The president of the force was there and everything. So they're fully behind the call for a ceasefire. But I think a lot of these healthcare workers are so disgusted with, first of all, hospitals being blown to bits. Second of all, healthcare workers dying. And third of all, healthcare workers being forced to do medical procedures, often without anaesthetic. Someone sent me a video a few days ago of a teenage girl having what was left of the rest of her leg being amputated without anaesthetic. It's horrendously cruel, horrendously barbaric. And this is what's happening day in, day out. So I can totally understand why the healthcare workers felt it necessary to put pressure on the government. They had 1,000 signatures within it, I think 24 hours, 48 hours or something, of fellow healthcare workers, from doctors, nurses, physios, speech and language, all sorts of grades within the sector represented there. And as you mentioned, Dr. Philomena Kenna, an anaesthetist who kind of started all of this based in Galway, as well with a number of Palestinian medical professionals working in the hospitals in Galway and in the universities. And they asked me to come on board as the president of the Trades Council, and we were fully supportive of it and anything that can be done to put pressure on the government to do something at a European level or as a country ourselves.
You forget, or not forget, it. You know, we know all the numbers of children that are being killed, but the specifics of the different occupations of people, though, we know there's been, you know, dozens of journalists who've been killed, more killed in this than any other war in history. And then, you know, of course, healthcare workers are another big part of it. Like, that was just one sign, physios, but there's doctors and nurses and all sorts.
Yeah.
But 56 minutes ago on Al Jazeera's website, an interesting article went up. It said it has World Health Organization chief has slammed comments from Israeli authorities accusing the UN agency of colluding with Hamas. Like, this is Israel. On the day that the ICJ makes a ruling that they're genocidal, they come out to the World Health Organization and accuse them of colluding with Hamas. Like, it's just distraction, distraction, distraction. We don't want to talk about that fact that we're going out there murdering and genocide in a genocidal way so many people, but they're just so, how can they just get away with it all the time, you know?
There's three from by late from the last bit of research I've done, there's three hospitals left functioning, guys, and they're all obviously below capacity as well, and stuffed full of people who are sheltering in these hospitals as well, because as we all know, hospitals are supposed to be areas that are safe. And if you're running from bombs, you can't get out. The one place you're going to go and try and save yourself and your family is a hospital, and they're being specifically targeted.
Yeah,
and how that isn't genocidal, I don't know.
You probably saw the pictures and the videos of the two kids, the two brothers yesterday in Gaza that were shot, Zaid and Naid, I think are the names. But like, the brothers were going to get food aid, and one of the brothers was shot, and the other brother was carrying on his back to try and get him away. So the sniper took out him as well. Like, it's you know, this stuff, it's being broadcast to us. How I still can't wrap my head around how the Irish government are now urgently seeking legal advice only today.
Yeah, only today. It's scandalous.
Absolutely scandalous.
Even in the Times today, there's an article saying that 20 people were killed in a food aid queue strike. So like a strike and a queue for people queuing for food aid in a country that is now facing famine. Yeah. And they attacked it. It was, it's I don't know, it gets very frustrating, because, I mean, if in one sense you feel hopeless, like, and help, or not hopeless, but helpless, watching all of this stuff happening and listening to the testimonies of people that are going through this, and we have an Irish government and two leaders of an Irish government that seem more concerned about their future jobs in the European Commission than they are about stopping what's happening in Gaza.
And that's it. And the only reason, I suppose, that some of those politicians in certain political parties are reacting up whatsoever now isn't just because of the ICJ, but it's because of the Irish public and the voting public. And that, you know, I hate to use the term populist, but they would happily sit back and allow Israel to do whatever it wants, and they would never hold them to account. But when they see 100,000 people out on the streets, and I suppose it's a good thing, and they see that those numbers out there, they're starting to go, Okay, maybe we need to do something a bit different here. So hopefully we join the case that, but a little bit too late for me.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's in some sense better late than never, but it's going to take 2 years at least for the court to actually have any findings on genocide anyway. So the hope in the interim report was that it had called for a ceasefire. That hasn't happened. But as the South Africans pointed out earlier today in their response, that none of the demands or none of the recommendations of the court are possible without a ceasefire. So we might see some pressure in that regard, hopefully. But as I said, the sanctions, it's the only way it's going to happen. It's the only way it happened in South Africa. Sanctions and economically isolating the country.
Sanctions, protests, and that's the other, I suppose, when you say about keeping hope and all the rest of it, like the amount of local actions that are taking place all across the country. And I don't mean just turning up the protests, but like people turn up with speakers playing audio or outside of McDonald's and saying how their collaborators are, that type of stuff does damage. And we know that it does damage to these companies who try for a long time to put on a brave face, but they can't keep it up forever. So if the protests
Even
continue.
locally in Galway, at the vigils and protests we've done, we've never seen numbers like it. And it's faces that I wouldn't recognize as well, you normally in a place like Galway, it's the same people that show up and everything all the time. But not in this case. There's lots of people from loads of different backgrounds that are coming out. We had an event last Thursday week in the Mechanics Institute in Galway called Understanding Palestine that we did with in collaboration between the Trades Council here and the Irish Centre for the Histories of Labour and Class based in the University of Galway. And it was more of a sort of an information evening, trying to challenge a lot of the disinformation and misinformation that's out there. So when people are looking at what's happening on their phones or on their tablets every day, and then they're seeing the news, it doesn't add up. So we tried to put on an event anyway to try and basically go through the in a historical context. This didn't happen. This didn't start on the 7th of October. It's been going on for 75 years and more. And we had numbers. We had to turn people away. The place was stuffed. People piling up the stairs and everything, trying to get into it, which was incredible. So we're now looking at doing a similar event, sort of understanding Palestine events again, given the historical context and all the rest of it, in a much bigger venue. So we're working on that at the moment. So people are coming up. People are just disgusted with what they're seeing, and they don't know what to do about it. And it's up to us as people that might have a little bit more knowledge in the situation to educate people as best we can into how to take action and what to actually do, to put pressure on governments and the international bodies.
And speaking of that, because I did see online that you were present at another meeting about Guantanamo Bay. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that one too?
I with Mansoor, yeah. Just
Our friend Mansour.
what a beautiful human being,
He's
to
great.
think what that man. So yeah, we decided to do a book launch after the meeting that a number of us, yourself included, we were in floods of tears at that meeting in Brussels to hear the expert testimony from Mansoor and his other brothers and the other people that were on the panel that day was I mean, I thought I knew what was going on, but when you hear it straight from someone who experienced it 14 years, completely innocent, tortured, abused, just have all sense of dignity and humanity stripped from them. And he comes out of there with a smile on his face and dedicates the rest of his life to seeking justice for the people that are left behind and searching for justice and accountability for everybody that was ever put through that horrendous system of torture and extraordinary rendition, kidnapping essentially.
Which the Irish government is complicit with.
Of course, through the use of Shannon Airport and possibly Ballydonald as well. So it was just again packed out the door. People couldn't get in. He spoke for about an hour, and again, everybody in the room was visibly moved by Mansour's testimony. And of course, Margaretta D'Arcy, the legend in Galway herself, the Guantanamo granny, as she's known as, who spent time in Limerick prison for trying to shut down Shannon Airport for the use of the US military. And just to see the reaction of of Mansour when he met her, straight over to embrace her was really beautiful. And I think he's an incredible testament to the strength of the human spirit, and just that no matter what you throw at someone, they get up, they smile. He still has a smile and a hug for everybody, and he's dedicating the rest of his life to justice and accountability. And I think he's just an amazing human being, and we were all delighted to have him in Galway, you know.
I can't really remember whether we covered it on this podcast, but there was a trip for a group of Irish, an Irish delegation organised by Claire Daly and Mick Wallace last October, I think it was, to go, might have been earlier, to go to Brussels and meet with and hear from a number of prisoners who went through Guantanamo Bay, starting obviously back in 2002, 2003, right up until, you know, today. There's still 32 people, I think, if memory serves me, 32 people still in Guantanamo Bay, but 16 of whom have been approved for release but can't be released until they find a sponsoring country where they can go to, and no charges against any of them. Of all of the 780 odd prisoners who went through Guantanamo Bay, 7 have been charged with crimes. All of the others have either been found innocent, released, or there was no evidence against them in the first place. What was presented to us at the time was that many of the prisoners who were brought to Guantanamo Bay were purchased, more or less, were bought by the American government after 9/11. They were paying anything from $3,000 up to $75,000 to take in a prisoner, or for a country to provide a prisoner. And of course, some of these people were literally picked off the streets so that somebody could obtain money, and they were put into a prison and their lives were ruined forever, and they spent up to 20 years in the prison at that time. But to hear the reaction from some of them, you know, and how positive they were, and how you know, it was just but you know, you might remember yourself, like, some of the expert speakers were very emotional as well, and there was a chaplain there, an American Army chaplain, a Muslim chaplain who was present on Guantanamo Bay and spotted all the torture that was going on and reported it, as per his contract of employment, reported it up the chain to say this shouldn't be happening. And instead of taking action on it, they actually sent him home and put him in prison in the United States for, I think it was 9 or 11 months or something like that.
They charged him with espionage.
That's it, because he was reporting prisoners being waterboarded, having their heads banged against a wall. Some of them became brain damaged as a result of that.
Which was part of his role as US military chaplain, is to report these things up the chain. They didn't like that.
Yeah, espionage. And it's an incredible story.
Of course,
and
then, one of the other people who presented that day was a woman whose name I've forgotten, who is a member of 9/11 Families for Peaceful Futures, I think was the organization she was a member of. So she had lost a nephew in the Twin Towers on 9/11. And they started a campaign to have Guantanamo Bay closed and have all the people released, because they are of the opinion that this is re-traumatizing them. Because what you're doing is you're torturing people that had nothing to do with what happened to their families. And I thought that was a very powerful presentation that she gave as well.
Yeah, there was a number of powerful presentations on the day. By the way, any listeners there will find this on YouTube. The entire conference that we attended was broadcast on YouTube live. But there was also a UN special rapporteur on human rights and counterterrorism, an Irish woman, I think, Fionnuala.
Fionnuala, yeah.
Yeah, and she was top class too. She was amazing. Like, really, really powerful, to put it in that human rights perspective of what was happening. But there was just so much in it. It was an incredible, powerful event. And I remember at the end of it, both Claire Daly and Mick Wallace just couldn't even talk because they were crying so much. Everybody was just in tears. We were all in bits. It was awful.
We all were, yeah.
But it's great that Mansour is doing a bit of a tour around Ireland the last month and a half or so, and promoting his book. His book for people
they're officially out of the books now, so they're doing another run of them. So if anybody wants one, I think you can order them in Connolly Books. You can certainly order them in Charlie Burns here in Galway. But I think if you go into Connolly Books, they should be able to order them for you as well, for the next batch.
The book is called Don't Forget Us
Don't
Here.
Forget Us Here.
Yeah, Mansour Adafi. Adafi,
yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So yeah, if anyone's interested, we'll post the book itself as well in the on our social medias, just in case people want to. Any other news there, Owen, that you want to touch on?
Yeah, I was looking at something in the Times there about there was a case about Irish water.
Oh, lovely. Always good for a bit of content.
Yeah. So the title is The EU Court Rules Ireland Failed to Protect Water from Carcinogens. So it goes back to 2010. The report is only released this week, but it goes back to 2010. Friends of the Irish Environment put in a complaint to the European Commission in relation to things called THMs in Irish water. They're trihalomethanes, which are supposed to be very carcinogenic. Right. And there's a significant number of 30 drinking water supplies, 9 of them private water groups, and 21 of them provided by Ishka Éireann that were that had significant numbers of these chemicals contained within them. Now, Irish Water have come back and said, yeah, look, we are in the process of upgrading a number of these sites. But if you go, there's 2 pages. Is it the next page? Yeah, on page 4. Rapid climate action needed to avoid extremes. Entire economy must be transformed, says assessment by energy experts. And that's talking about climate. And in the very last paragraph of that, this is underlines the projected changes over coming decades showed wide variability, but increases in floods and droughts are likely. As a consequence, increases in water temperature and changes in rainfall patterns and extremes are likely to increase pressures on water quality. So if you link those two articles together, we're under big pressure for a country that has an awful lot of resource when it comes to fresh water, as we all know too well in the west of Ireland. We're going to be under significant pressure in the coming years to try and create a system and a water supply system in this country that's fit for purpose.
Yeah,
and that ties back, I think, to a referendum on Irish water remaining in public ownership. But it's not just about a referendum of remaining in public ownership. We also need investment, significant state-led investment in a proper nationalized water system in this country.
Yeah.
And the sooner we get on that, the better, because time is running out, as we all know.
Yeah. Well, look, that bill for the referendum was passed back in 2016, November, I think, October, November 2016. And it's been going through the processes in the Dáil for the past 8 years. It's gone. Like, they don't want to pass. They don't want a constitution amendment on this stuff. So even though
they don't.
A year ago, the government said it is committed to holding a referendum on water. Everything is a slowdown on all this stuff. They can have an urgency. There's an urgency around certain things when they want them to pass, like banks being recapitalized and all the rest of it, but not on stuff like the protection of our water systems. Well, that's an interesting one. I must look up that
and
report.
To be honest with you, I'm not sure I'd trust this government at the moment to even put forward proper legislation around a constitutional amendment, considering the absolute mess they're making of the two upcoming referendums this year. Ones that I would have been, you know, in general, quite supportive of, removing, you know, the woman's place in the home from the constitution, and to acknowledge care workers in the constitution, which are both very important things to be done. But I was watching Catherine Connolly in the Dáil 2 days ago. Catherine Connolly's a TD from Galway, someone I would trust vehemently in her capacity to scrutinize legislation, has said that she would sooner stick with the current wording in the constitution than go in favor of the wording that the government has currently put forward. So that has me very, very worried now, because I'd have a lot of trust in Catherine's capacity to analyze and critique legislation properly. And if she's worried about this, I think the government is looking, this could fail, especially if people like Catherine Connolly are saying, hang on a second, this wording is terrible. So they skipped through a lot of stages, pre-legislative scrutiny. They didn't look at the citizens' assembly or anything to look at any of this. They've just gone ahead and put wording together themselves. And even both Dermot Farrelly and Stephen Collins both have columns on it today in the papers. Dermot Farrelly's one is, might history repeat itself in referendum debate? And Stephen Collins' one is politicians don't seem worried about referendums failing. So there's already a bit of controversy about this, and they're going to spend a significant amount of money too, getting these referendums through. And I just think if they're, it should just be worded properly.
Yeah, the cynic in me makes, on certain issues around referendum, makes me think that sometimes the government is not that they even don't care, is that they don't want certain things to pass. They word it wrong. Like, I've seen one of the drafts of the wording for the referendum on water. And I think the whole thing was done to split people who are in favor of it because it was so badly worded. But it was effectively putting Irish water into the constitution as a state body into the institution, not the public ownership of water, but the public ownership of Irish water as an institution, and knowing that Irish water was a hated, you know, semi-state body. So yeah, part of me, the cynic in me, thinks that sometimes they're not just okay with it failing, but they actually want it to fail.
Even Stephen Collins is in his article, he says some government TDs even take the view that it may act as a convenient safety valve, allowing the voters to indulge in a consequence-free protest vote and get some of the resentments out of their system in advance of a serious electoral contest due to take place later this year. So the cynic in you is shared by a number of people, I think.
People I don't normally agree with.
People who wouldn't normally agree with, that's for sure.
The other news, I suppose, from a trade union perspective is the public sector pay deal. Now, we don't have a huge amount of details in it, but 10.25% over 2.5 year period. So what's that? About, you know, 4% or so, if you were to, you know, put it out on an annual basis. The deal, it's for 385,000 public servants, including nurses, doctors, guardian teachers. And it, you know, it's after prolonged debate and discussions, but it's an improvement on what was there. They were, I think, 8.5%.
Still falls far short from what the unions were looking for at 12.5%, which was already, I think, conservative, in my opinion. But they have come out and said, I think it was Owen Reedy said earlier on, look, this is the best we're going to get through negotiations.
Yeah. So now, and of course, it's up to the members now.
Exactly.
So that's the important part of these processes, is that if, because I've been seeing a lot of people on the left tweeting that it's not enough and not happy with it and all the rest of it, and that's fair enough. The question now is, what are the members going to do? Because this is the trade unionism. This is how it plays out. You know, people get a say in their own terms and conditions. So if you're not a member of a trade union and they have an opinion on this, you want to join one. Join the public sector fairly rapidly.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What other issues were out there that I was looking at? I was looking at one, the Ryanair housing debate. That's a really interesting one for me in particular at the moment, and I'm sure you too, you'd be interested in it too. But our listeners probably know already, but Ryanair have bought 25 out of 28 homes in an area of Swords called Fosterstown. It's on the Dublin Airport side of Swords. It's actually very close to where I live, and you know, the place I walk by or go by every day, nearly every day. And as a local in the area, it's very interesting because for the last 6 to 8 months, as those houses have been, you know, almost completed, most of them are completed now, but people keep posting online on all of the local chats saying, when are these going up for sale? How can we get, you know, asking all the local councillors, Anne Graves and Dean Mulligan in particular, you know, how are we going to get our hands on these? Because there's huge demand, pent up demand in Swords. You know, it's one of the fastest growing regions in Europe in population wise. So you can imagine the demands. And then all of a sudden, every single one of them snapped up by Ryanair. So there's murder. There's real agitation going on around some of this stuff. And of course, it's in the housing minister's own constituency. So he's probably concerned about the optics of something like this. Now, bear in mind, right, because I'm a local, because I know about, you know, I was a postman in the area as well, that Ryanair already have a lot of properties that they use for their staff in Bereva, which is the housing estate that these houses are in. So it's not like this is the first time this has happened. But what's interesting now is that they're, you know, bulk purchasing because of the housing crisis. And where does that lead to? And I think, you know, you being a member of Mandate Trade Union, we have a history on this issue of employers.
Absolutely.
Yeah, employers owning the property that you live in.
Yep.
You know, the disincentive for trade union activity, you can't really go on strike. Because if you go on strike, you know, there's no detriment to your terms and conditions of employment if they just up your rent. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
yeah, it's certainly a worrying trend. I mean, if this starts happening across the board, like I could see large retailers doing the same thing next. And yeah, absolutely contrary to everything a trade union stands for. And yeah, as you said, how willing would you be to go on strike to defend your terms and conditions if it means you're going to be homeless?
Yeah. And like, it's a return to history for us in the trade union movement, and it is real regression, because I'm doing a lot of research at the moment. It's the 30th anniversary of the union that I work for and that you're a member of, Mandate Trade Union. I'm looking up the Living In system, which most of our listeners wouldn't be familiar with. And the Living In system existed from the, you know, 19th century right through to 1923 or so. And it was a system where drapery workers, grocery workers, a whole range of different workers in retail were obliged to live in the place where they worked. So Cleary's, Arnott's, you know, Brown Thomas, these were all living in systems. So all the staff that worked in there would have to live in there. And the purpose of it was you would be paying a worker maybe £100 a year back then. But if they left their candles lit too late at night, you could deduct money from them. Every house, as they were called, had a rule, or had a set of rules. One in particular, one house had 96 rules. And if you breached any of them, you'd end up with no money at the end of the month when you're supposed to be paid. And of course, the union recognized very early on in you know, the late 1800s to the early 1900s, that this was a hindrance on their ability to organize workers. Because again, how could you go on strike in a place where you live? And, but not only that, big concerns around issues, like there were concerns around fires. For instance, in 1905, there was a fire on Camden Street, which claimed the lives of three 18-year-old women, Mary Scaly, Bridget McGuinness, and a woman called Kate O'Flanagan. But everybody in the Living In system was locked in. There was no health and safety concerns. And, you know, we've just come through COVID, and this is the thing that really bugs me about this stuff. Like, you might think it doesn't impact on a case like Ryanair, but like the spread of typhoid fever in 1898 was in Ireland, where Belfast was the worst city in the world for the spread of this. A large part of that was down to the Living In system. It's called barrack living. You had up to 200, 300 people living in a handful of rooms. Like, you could have 40 or 50 people living in a room, and one person gets ill and they all get ill. And, you know, leads to huge deaths. Now, with the Ryanair situation, we don't know what the housing situation is going to be. Will Ryanair be renting that out to families of staff, or is it just for staff of Ryanair to live in? So, for instance, if it's a three-bedroom house, are they going to make staff share and have bunk beds in there and maybe have four people to a room? We don't know, because there's no regulations around this stuff. And that's a major concern.
Sleeping in shifts.
Yeah.
You know, you don't even have your own bed. It's only your bed while you're in it.
Yeah. You can have the house for 12. You can have the bedroom for 12 hours of the day, and they're on at the other 12 hours. Yeah. There's real serious concerns from a health and safety perspective, from a workers' rights perspective, around employers doing this, snapping these up, because, you know, everybody's talking about the unfairness of people, not, you know, saving up for years to buy houses locally, you know, in the place where they wanted to live near their families and all the rest of it, and then they just snapped up. So it's a double unfairness, because those could be the very people who end up in a job there and then can't go and strike for better terms and conditions and pay to be able to move out and get somewhere else because they're dependent on their employer for accommodation.
Yeah.
So it's you know, it's a pretty scary and not so good situation for the locals in that area, but everywhere else, because Ryanair, I wouldn't say they're setting a precedent, because I'm pretty sure it's happening in other places. You might have more.
You can be certain it's happening all across the way. Like, I mean, there's definitely other employers around, hospitality employers, retail employers, that are looking at this as a solution. Whereas the solution for us as working class people is state investment in universal public housing. That's the only way to solve the housing crisis in this country, to build up social housing stock. Even though I hate calling it stock because it's actual people's homes. You know what I mean? That's part of the problem is property and people's homes are just seen as a commodity to be traded and to extract profit from, rather than it's somewhere where you live and raise a family and, you know, it's your home.
And, makes it sound like it's a television instead of a roof over your head.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And it's the only, as I said, it's universal public housing available to everybody and anybody at a percentage of your income, I think is the only solution to the housing crisis in Ireland.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one to watch now. Keep an eye on it. I'll keep an eye on it locally to see if there's any protests that might pop up there. But yeah, I don't know if you've got any other stories that might wrap it up after that. If you do, if not, we'll wrap it up now.
Yeah, that's pretty much all I had anyway to talk about, Dave. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, thanks again to Owen for joining us here on The Week at Work. The Week at Work is part of Left Bloc, an alternative media and political education project. If you want to know more about us, you can go to our website, leftbloc.ie. You can also support us there or on patreon.com/leftbloc. Thanks for listening, and we talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Dave.